Good morning. Here is the early morning news of the world, reported to you through the facilities of the National Broadcasting Company by NBC correspondents abroad. For the news in England this morning, we take you now to London.
This is London at about 2 o'clock. Fred Bates speaking. Except for slight damage at two southwest England points, Britain had a raid-free night last night. The Royal Air Force, on the other hand, kept up their pressure on Germany and northern France yesterday and last night. They included an attack on Brest, the port in Brittany, where those three German warships still lie. The exchange in high military posts, suddenly announced last night, occupies most front pages today. General Sir Archibald Wavell, Commander-in-Chief in the Middle East, will, as you know, trade commands with Lieutenant General Sir Claude Auchinleck, Commander-in-Chief in India. Official comment last night was that the sustained pressure under which General Wavell has been working for months has produced a strain which it was felt could not be indefinitely prolonged. That obviously would leave a public which admires General Wavell and whose achievements are known to them wondering what had really happened. This morning it's made clear that these are understood to be wartime appointments, the duration of which depends on the military situation. The Middle East command in this war has been and is far more than a field of military activity. From this command, campaigns have been conducted in North Africa, Abyssinia, Greece, Crete, and Syria. The Times editorial explains today that forces which began operations more than 2,000 miles from Cairo, and which were not based on Egypt at all, have fought under Cairo's orders, that is, under the Middle East command. It has had semi-political relations with Greece and Turkey, with the French in Syria and Somaliland, and with the Free French movement in Africa. Another angle of the work of this pressed command has been the reorganization of civil life in Abyssinia. The intricate coordination of combining military operations with those of the Mediterranean fleet and with the Royal Air Force all over this Mediterranean area has also been the work of the Middle East Command. Even supplies come to this command direct from India, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, and many other places. This has meant an enormous increase in the responsibilities of the Commander-in-Chief. Propaganda, both coming into the Mediterranean countries and Egypt and going out from this whole area toward Britain, is a very real arm in this different war. It was felt that these various responsibilities should be subdivided, and so a new experiment is being tried. That is the appointment of Mr. Oliver Littleton to be Minister of State and assigned to this Middle East area. There is, of course, Egypt itself, which has been the center of efforts other than British in the way of propaganda and persuasion, and for a long time. Mr. Littleton's base will be Cairo. His presence there as a full member of the War Cabinet will give the Middle East Commander-in-Chief permanent on-the-spot collaboration with a representative of the War Cabinet. It's hoped that this arrangement will relieve the military command of those complicated problems which are not military, leaving his hands free to plan and operate in his own field. This, incidentally, is the first time a cabinet minister has been assigned to a foreign zone of hostility. The move underlines the fact that politics, propaganda, and economics are vital factors in this war, and this appointment must be regarded as one of initiative. General Auchinleck is 57, 1 year younger than General Wavell. He led the Allied expedition that captured Narvik. Later, he reorganized defenses here in Britain and is held in very high esteem. General Wavell, who now goes to India, has a brilliant record as an organizer and administrator. He's captured the public imagination. It's hinted today that his special qualifications are needed in India to reorganize defenses there against a possible German drive, should operations in Russia give Berlin that opportunity. The contention that Russia's industrial power is not dependent on the Ukraine and Caucasus is set forth in a long article by Professor Turin, lecturer on Russian economics at London University. Though the Ural Mountains in the east, he said, produce only 10% of Russia's oil, huge reserves have been built up at the rate of some 5 million tons a year for several years. 60% of the entire output of iron now comes from the Urals. The same applies to coal. June was a mixture of weather. It was the coldest for 5 years, the wettest for many years, and June 22nd was the hottest June day on record here. We return you now to the National Broadcasting Company in New York.
And that was NBC's staff reporter in London. Now, in the newsroom here in New York, we have the latest news from the Russian high command. The Russians now claim to have the Germans stopped on all major fronts. A Red Army communique says the advanced tank forces, which the Nazis had sent into the Minsk and Vinsk areas, have been wiped out. Thus, the communique says the Germans have been halted in their drives toward Moscow and Leningrad. The Red Army says that further south, in the region around Luk, heavy blows have been dealt to the attacking German armies. Far to the north, above the Arctic Circle, the Russians claim to be putting up fierce resistance to Germans driving toward Murmansk. The Russian communique says weather conditions along most of the front were bad during the past 12 hours, too bad in most cases for aircraft operations. And now, abroad again, this time to Berlin for the report of Charles Lanius. Go ahead, Berlin.
Hello, NBC. This is Charles Lanius in Berlin. The story behind the capture of Riga was told here this morning. German troops, it's reported, began the final assault on the Latvian town at 5 o'clock yesterday morning. A German advance unit got into the city before the Russians were able to blow up the bridges. But, according to the Germans, the Reds managed to explode the bridge mines a few minutes later, and the German unit was cut off. The fighting in the town was bloody, the Germans say, and the trapped German unit was completely wiped out in fierce hand-to-hand fighting. Meanwhile, stronger German groups forced the river, fought their way into Riga, and after a battle lasting several hours, the city was in German hands at about 10 o'clock yesterday morning, just 5 hours after the operation had started. Today, the Germans announced intense air bombardments on bridges, railroads, highways, troop concentrations, and airfields in the entire Baltic area, especially in the district of Pleskou, on the Peipus Lake. Pleskou is the division point on the railroad leading to Leningrad. For the first time, the Germans tell of bombing the harbor of Murmansk and the mining town of Kirvosk, near Murmansk in the north. Other early military reports here show that, generally speaking, the German spearhead thrusts are continuing to cut deep into the interior of Russia. At some point, it appears that the fast, tough German motorized advance columns have knifed their way into Soviet country to a depth of 250 miles, which, in the opinion of most military-minded people here, is pretty fast going. These German speed troops are the essence of German blitzkrieg warfare. They drive fire into enemy territory, regardless of the strength on their flanks, executing encircling movements, splitting enemy lines, forming bags, cutting off Russian divisions from their main forces, preventing them from reforming their lines, and holding key positions until German reinforcements are set up. In this kind of slashing warfare, military men agree that the Luftwaffe is indispensable. The dive bombers, fighters, and pursuit planes keep the Soviet ground troops busy and away from the spearhead columns, prevents the Reds from reforming by bombing troop concentrations, railroads, and highways, and above all, they say, protects the German panzers from the apparently ponderous Soviet air force. A fair example of German technique is the show that's now going on east of Belyostok, where two Red armies have been trapped for nearly a week. The Germans struck through the Russian front at two points, roughly about 60 miles apart, got into Soviet territory to a considerable depth on both sides of the Red armies, and then boxed them in. Reinforcements followed them in and are now squeezing the Russians from all sides. But evidently, the German general staff didn't think that was enough, so they sent in their panzers in to drive two thin but powerful wedges through the trapped armies. Now it seems the Red armies are divided into three groups, and the Germans have begun to systematically work on each separate group. Here it's said, the Russians will have to surrender shortly or be wiped out entirely. It's a game that the Germans invented and perfected, and which the Russians apparently don't understand. And nearly any German military man will tell you that when the Soviets massed their troops right on the frontier, they were playing into German hands. Now the Germans can destroy and capture the best troops and material the Reds have without getting too far away from home. In fact, I am told by usually well-informed sources here that the Germans are feeling pretty good about the whole thing. Although the Germans still haven't much to say about the offensive in the Ukraine, reports coming into Berlin indicate that German and Romanian troops are in the Ukraine proper and are pushing forward. One report today tells how the Allied troops have found whole towns and villages in the Ukraine deserted by the population. The villagers, terrified at what the retreating Russians might do, fled into the woods to hide until the Germans arrived. They are said to have told the Germans that the Reds had taken away all the cattle, poultry, pigs, and horses, and everything else they could carry with them, and shot any peasant who remonstrated or got in their way. Reports from other battle zones say that the fighting is particularly fierce and that few prisoners are being taken because the Russians have been told that they'll be tortured if the Germans get them. A favorite trick of the Reds, it said, is to play dead and then start shooting on unsuspecting German soldiers in the night. The war with England shows no signs of letting up. During the night, four British bombers, which attempted to enter France and North German coastal area, were shot down, according to the Germans. The Luftwaffe attacked the harbors in the east, southeast, and southwest coasts of England. And it said that in the Atlantic waters around England, three merchant ships totaling 12,000 tons were sunk. This is Charles Lanius in Berlin. I now return you to NBC in New York.
And that's the latest news of the war. For the last word on what is going on in the United States Capitol, we present Earl Godwin speaking from our newsroom in Washington.
And good morning, folks. The President, Mr. Roosevelt, is scheduled to speak to you and the nation and the world at large 4 o'clock Eastern Time, daylight time, on July 4, on a program under the auspices of Mayor LaGuardia, Director of Civilian Defense, who asks me personally to relay this information personally to you and for you to make it a personal program. The President may report to you the latest news in America, on America, and the war. And I understand the nation will be asked to recite, will have the opportunity to recite all together the pledge of fealty to the flag, and what a tremendous upsurge of Americanism there can be then. The President, by the way, at Hyde Park yesterday, reiterated his hope that this country can be kept out of war, but he certainly made no promises. Same time, it should be recalled that by a series of moves, the President has served notice on the world this government intends to keep a flow of goods going to Britain, but will try to avoid a shooting war. Meantime, Russia finally comes across and asks Sumner Wells, acting Secretary of State, for a long list of war goods. The details were not made public, but we understand they were largely machine tools and stuff they can use in the oil fields. Not many days ago, Leon Henderson, the price control czar here, admitted he'd gone about as far as he could, holding back the ocean of prices without help. And so, in effect, he said, there ought to be a law. It seems, too, the President thinks there ought to be a law, but there are those in Congress who'll fight to the last ditch against any ironclad compulsory price-fixing powers, because somehow or other the farm bloc in Congress, which is now in the saddle, has the idea that price-fixing will do a great harm to the horny-handed sons of toil. The farmers in Congress were joined by the anti-New Dealers and all the Republicans to block and defeat a resolution merely to investigate the cost of living. On the other hand, Mr. Henderson warns that the spending the American public is now doing and may be expected to do in larger volume as the billions from the Treasury go through the defense machinery and come out in the payrolls is certainly going to shoot living costs sky high. Incidentally, most of the larger labor unions saw that argument months ago and used it as a solo to sing their song about higher wages. But now, Congress, hearing that the administration wants a price control law that will include rents based on a permitted 8% return on capital, is in a fury of confusion and indecision. There's one thing as sure as you're sitting there. No matter what else is limited in price, the farm block on Capitol Hill will die in the last ditch before it permits Leon Henderson or anybody else to lay a hand on one single stalk of wheat or a bowl of cotton as to prices. And Washington waits a triumphal entry of Texas Governor W. Leo Daniel, who apparently has defeated New Deal Representative Lyndon Johnson for the seat in the Senate, made vacant by the death of Andrew Jackson Houston, who was sent to Washington by this same Governor O'Daniel to take the place made vacant by the death of Senator Morris Shepherd. O'Daniel, former flower salesman, campaigns with a hillbilly band, jazz and homespun speech, promising old-age pensions to one and all, defeated 3 strong men and 21 also-rans, defeated Johnson, the New Dealer, who was backed plentifully by cash money, Jerry Mann, Texas state attorney, who was an idol of the Lone Star football fans, and Martin Dyes, chairman of the Un-American Activities Committee. And that's all from Washington at this time.
And that's the news in the world at this minute. This is the National Broadcasting Company.